Welcome to The Right Chamber,
the podcast where we dive deep into the fascinating world of medicine and healthcare.
In every episode, we will talk about pivotal topics relating to medicine and surgery in the UK and what it's like to be a healthcare professional today. We are inviting doctors and other healthcare professionals across different specialties to discuss their experiences and give an insight into what their journey has been like. Please follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS and subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media. So sit back, ignore the traffic, and enjoy the Right Chamber podcast.
Today we have Omar Mustafa, who's one of our surgical residents with distinction in medical degree, and he's a member of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh. He actively participates in clinical education and medical student mentorship before 4 a.m. or after 5 p.m. He's also an aviation and swimming enthusiast.
Welcome back to the Right Chambers podcast. Happy 2025. I am Dr. Victor, and
I'm Jaspreet.
Hi, everyone. I am Omar.
Brilliant. Today, we are going to be speaking on the topic of career decisions and surgical training and applications. Why don't we start by you just telling us a little bit about yourself, Omar, so the people can get to know you.
Yeah.
So the real you.
The real me. Oh, God. I'm a current co-surgical trainee in my second year in the West Midlands Deanery. And I have spent almost most of my life in Birmingham. So I have studied in Birmingham, both in undergrad, and I did my foundation training in Walsall for 2 years before applying for core surgical training and thankfully getting in. And despite all the fiascos with the MSRAs and all the changes to the applications and the portfolios, and currently now on my trauma orthopedic rotation. So I have 18 months of trauma orthopedics. Before that, I did 6 months of general surgery, and hopefully applying to be a trauma orthopedic registrar. So we were talking earlier about gaining weight and stress eating and all of that stuff. Yeah, that is happening soon. Yeah. Or it is happening. I should be starting preparing, but yeah. So yeah, that is me. I did a postgraduate certificate in clinical education with Keele, again, West Midlands. And hopefully do a diploma or a master's at some point, but let's get other things out of the way first.
So you have a very big interest in teaching as well.
I have an interest in teaching, and even more so, I have an interest in aviation. That's something outside the air. So it's probably stopping me from progressing in my academic career, but I'm interested in aviation. See, big time flight simulation merchant, I would say. I've done so for 14, 15 years, and love swimming. Do that so many times in the week.
If you've seen some of our previous episodes, if you have.
If I have, yeah.
There's an orthopedic consultant who's very much into,
yes.
Is this just aviation and orthopedics go hand in hand somehow?
No, it's just a thing. It's just,
you guys in planes?
It's Sajid. Funnily enough, she's actually my supervisor as well. So, if
you bond over aviation.
We did, and it's something unique. You don't tend to find people interested in that field or that area alongside orthopedics, for example. There might be someone out there again that is interested, but it's something that you don't come across on a daily basis. So yes, we did bond over that, but equally it. A big part of it is because I'm originally from Egypt, and I used to travel a lot when I was a kid before I entered medicine and sacrificed my my life. But I just like always just love planes, and we talk about career decisions, right? I never wanted to be a doctor.
Really? Oh, what was the initial plan?
I wanted to be a plane engineer.
Okay.
But
something changed.
What changed?
Yeah, I I don't want
to Aryan.
It's the Asian
culture.
I don't want to fit the stereotype per se, but part of it was being influenced by higher powers, and being talked sense into. Medicine is the way to go. And in retrospect, if I was given the choice, I would go medicine again. It was never medicine to begin with. It was always some sort of engineering. It's probably why I'm going down the orthopedic route. There's so many...
It's engineering.
It's so bioengineering based. And there's always new things being developed, new models, new toys, gadgets, all of that stuff.
It wasn't always surgery, was it? Initially, you thought about other things. So tell us
a little bird told us.
Yeah, if there are people that will be listening to this and watching this that know I was called a med reg. I was always interested in medicine, only medicine. I loved medicine. And I actually wanted to be a med reg at some point until I did medicine. So that was all throughout medical school. I wanted to do anesthetics at some point as well, just like everyone goes through a phase. And I applied for foundation training with the thought, you know what, I want to do anesthetics / ITU / medicine. And I did my medical rotation, and although I learned a lot, to be politically correct, it was an experience where I felt I wanted to do more than just perhaps see the patients on the ward round and put thorough plans and review all the investigations and do what all the medical doctors do. I want to do a bit more. And when I moved on to my surgical rotation, that's when I realized the extra bit is actually doing the surgery. It's almost like completing that loop of care. You see the patient, you start triaging them, you start the initial treatment, but there's always that extra bit of treatment that in medicine, perhaps you don't offer, you don't do, mainly because you don't need it. But in surgery, you do. And for example, we talked about oncology earlier and cancers, resections, life-changing. And if it's not life-changing, it's life-sustaining. The patients that come in, for example, in orthopedics with hip fractures, you do the surgery to reduce mortality. Yes, a lot of them actually get back on their feet and go home, but there will be some that don't recover very well. And some of these operations are palliative operations, but you could still do something. Could still use your skill set to make an impact.
There's quality of life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the quality of life and using your own hands to take matters into your own hands, rather. To try and improve someone's quality of life is not just a big reward, but it's such a big responsibility. And with great responsibilities come great rewards and good feeling after you've done an operation. You feel like, you know what, this is good.
So does it upset you when people are like, orthopods know nothing? The stereotypes.
Ortho bros.
Well, as you guys interviewed previously on the podcast, it's the stereotype is there, and it's up to the individual to change that stereotype. I could have gone into surgical training with absolutely no other interests in medicine and have zero knowledge of ABGs and all of that jazz. But at the end of the day, you represent the profession and you represent the team and the job that you do. So it's if you decide to not care about the medical part, that's down to you. But at the end of the day, you're still representing the profession. So it does annoy me a bit because there are people out there that don't actually care enough about other aspects of it. But medicine as a whole profession and trauma orthopedics as a specialty has evolved significantly.
100%.
So it's no longer just bones, fixed bones.
There's a fracture, fix it.
Fracture, fix it, fracture, that YouTube video. But it's moved and it's evolved. It's the introduction of orthogeries, for example. Now the tariffs that introduced by NHS England and NICE guidelines to try and improve patient care, it's all part of a bundle where you need to look at the patient holistically. And also the trauma aspect in orthopedics, it's not just, again, fractures or lacerations. There's a lot more pathophysiology going on. You just need to know a lot more. So actually, there was a study that was published in the BMJ that it was a while ago, and it was debatable. It was more of like a retrospective small study. They did a questionnaire. They'd given a questionnaire to anaesthetists, a number of anaesthetists and a number of orthopedic surgeons, and they wanted to find out who has the higher IQ, essentially. And turns out the orthopods actually scored higher on that test. It was published in the BMJ. Of course, you know, I'm not going to critically appraise the study and say how it was and debate it, but I have it printed at home and
framed and everything.
Yeah, framed and everything. So, yeah, the stereotype is something that you can control sometimes.
That's amazing. I didn't know that there'd been such massive kind of improvements going forward and advancements. So that's really, really interesting to hear.
There is in the whole of surgery as well, to be honest, not just trauma orthopedics. Surgery as a profession and as a job and as a career, you know, the involvement of academia, research, you know, you think of research and you think of professors. There's always so many professors of medicine. There's always so much going on in medicine, in the field of oncology and rheumatology and cardiology. But nowadays, even in surgery, there's so much surgical research going on. I mean, evident by, you know, the academic clinical fellowships that people can apply for and surgical rotations and how competitive they can be. Nowadays, more and more people are undertaking research in surgical subspecialties, like in things like breast, which is part of general surgery, or doing specific trauma-related research. And so, like, I know in London, they're doing like some big research on ethnic disparities in tendon repairs and patients that require tendon repairs. So there's so much going on nowadays.
Yeah. And like getting into it and the application process, talk us through that. Was that smooth sailing or?
You're giving me flashbacks. It wasn't smooth sailing because when I decided to do surgery, it was at a time where everyone else had probably already got their portfolio sorted. So I was starting from scratch. I had not had I didn't have a logbook. I didn't have any audits, didn't have anything. So I started an FY1 again when the epiphany hit in general surgery as an FY1. Thanks to my supervisor at the time, Miss Abbott at Warsaw, you know, she was one of those people who encouraged me to come to theatre, not to push me to do surgery, but just to, you know, expose myself to the field, develop my skill. And slowly, slowly, there were her and other members of the team were giving me time to do things like skin suturing, closure, incisions. And slowly, slowly, you gain a reputation within the field, within the job, rather. And people are like, oh, you know what? He can assist, you know, bring him to theatre. And that's how I built my logbook. So I did have to go in on off days, weekends, had to negotiate with some of the court trainees and be like, please, I need my numbers. And go to theatre. So the logbook aspect, I had to sacrifice a lot. But at the same time, then I had to work on audits and I didn't have any publications. So it wasn't smooth sailing because I had to start from scratch. But I think what I found very useful is I printed out what needed to be done. And I just had it as a reminder on a daily basis how much I need to do to in order to progress in the right direction. So it's very easy to get overwhelmed and be like, oh yeah, 40 surgical cases. Maybe I'll try and do them in 2 days or something. You can easily get overwhelmed. Oh yeah, an auditor, I need to close the loop. But I think the biggest thing that I learned from the whole process of how to build a portfolio is just start somewhere and go with the flow. You can start an audit, work on one. If you're given another opportunity to do another audit, work on another, and just let them all carry on in the background, do other things. And eventually things will fall into place. In my circumstance, I was also preparing for the MRCS Part A. And then I think day before the results, they announced that the MRCS does no longer count for the applications. Then they introduced the MSRA. So then you had to start prepping for another exam. And I'm sure everyone has heard about, you know, how competitive that exam is. And
MSRA is
score.
Something else.
The scores are ridiculously high. But it shows that, you know, people are, if you just sit in your own place, in your own position and try not to progress or think I've got time, you might have time for now, but it's always best to start early and look into things early. Yeah. And don't leave it till the last minute. Not to say that you should just, you know, work so hard from the beginning. You just work smart, you know.
It's getting like publications and audit. It's not like a 1 week or one day jobs.
No.
You need a few months for that.
Months and sometimes years.
Yes, publications especially.
Especially publications. And the biggest issue with publications is finding the right supervisors and finding the right mentors. Because sometimes you'll be in places where you don't have the right mentors. And I have been grateful. So I'm grateful that I've had the opportunity here at Russell's Hall and in the West Midlands that I've met supervisors and mentors who, you know, took me under their wing and decided, you know what, we can invest in you, give you a project, work on it. And you reap those fruits, you know, you work hard, you show them that you can work hard and eventually something will come out of your work. But it's very easy to get very bogged down by the little details. Oh, yeah, I need a publication in an impact factor journal of 10, you know, who cares? As far as your research is in fact impactful and you've learned something from the process. So a lot of the time people do research for the sake of doing research. And getting a publication, but getting a number. But you learn a lot from the process of critically appraising, reading an abstract, number analysis. And it shows when you go for an interview, for example, if you can talk in a scientific manner, if you're able to critically appraise the evidence that is presented to you, it's different from someone who was just doing publications just to get a number, you know.
It's a good skill to have.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like networking is quite big as well. You know, going out there and actually getting to know people, find mentors, as you've said, that are useful. Because it sounds like, yeah, having help can go a long way.
Yeah, and I think one of the things now in the digital age and all of that stuff is there is social media that you could use for personal use. And there's social media that you can use to network with people. Prime example of that is MedTwitter. So, you know, there's so many people on Twitter that use Twitter for personal aspects. And then there's people on Twitter that use it to network, talk about research, talk about their own publications. LinkedIn is another source. If you don't want social media, if you're a person that likes things face to face, at the very minimum, there are conferences going all year around, both at local level, regional, national level. So for those interested in surgery, there's the ASIC conference in March. Doesn't have to be just orthopedics, doesn't just have to be general surgery. Expose yourself. You might meet like-minded people, people that are working on similar projects, or people might be of completely different sort of specialty or grade, but they have skill sets that can benefit you. So you can always collaborate. And that's I think, where work and research is heading and all this and things like this. That's where it's heading, collaborative work. Much more time efficient, and it's much more recognizable nowadays when you've done an audit that is collaborative nationally. It sounds much better.
Bigger data set, like
bigger data set,
better results.
Absolutely. And when it comes to publishing those data sets and results, you can easily talk about how applicable it is and generalizable the results are, compared to if you do an audit of 1,000 patients locally at Russell's Hall, for example. Yeah, the data might not be generalizable. If you do something national, collaboratively even, and it doesn't take much sometimes. So recently, the orthopedic department, I led the data collection for a national project looking at forearm fractures. And the data is being presented and published now. But all I did was collect data. So my part is small, but sort of...
It's part of a bigger puzzle.
Absolutely. It's like, yeah, there's a bigger pond there. There's a domino effect. My work will add to other people's work, and then we get published in somewhere national.
And that's another way to like network, because you are telling different consultants from different... states in UK that I have this research, would you be interested in? And then they know, okay, look, this kid's interested in something like this, and that helps with the job as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of people realize it late, that you people talk, and it's not just that consultant that you met who thinks you're great at research, or that consultant will tell another consultant, oh, you know what, I've got this really good doctor who knows how to use Cochrane RevMan, or, oh, he's good at writing discussions, or he knows how to submit papers, which is a whole different skill. But people talk and the word spreads. And at the end of the day, you have a reputation, especially if you, the way the UK it sort of training works, you know, national selection, got a deanery. The deanery will find out about you, about what you have done, etc., through this one consultant who works in one hospital. So it's always good to be on the good side and have some, you know, good habits, good reputations in reserve for these moments.
So are you happy with your decision about moving on from medicine to surgery?
How's it going?
So I think you should ask me that question. If the podcast is still on for the next 10 years, ask me in 10 years' time. If I was given the opportunity to restart the whole process, I would. And I would go down the same route. I would make the same mistakes, and I would try and end up being in the same place again. Because at no point did I regret applying. Yes, there are so many challenges, and burnout is real, and you do get easily fatigued, and you can easily also overlook your own fatigue and put it down to, oh, you know, I just had a bad day, or, oh yeah, this operation didn't go well, or I've had X number of referrals, therefore I am tired. It's very easy to overlook it. it's very easy to also neglect your own well-being in the process for the sake of, oh, I need to make sure I get my numbers, etc. So the one part that I would say I would do better, if I go through the whole process again, I will do better moving forward, is look after myself, because no one will look after you. And at the end of the day, you are responsible for your own well-being and responsible for also raising concerns, if there are any concerns. But yeah, find out in 10 years time when hopefully I will consult it, but I don't regret it. It be surgery every day of the year if I'm given the chance.
And then when you need a break, you just fly away.
Yeah, that's where every emotion comes in.
Fly or try, yeah. Fly away, physically or through a simulation, or just try not to drown. Swimming is hard, but yeah, it's try and have a hobby outside of work. Something to look forward to after 5 or after 8.
So you're not the stereotypical ortho bro who just goes to the gym.
I'm not going to make any comments.
For those not watching, he just looked at himself.
I'll let them decide.
That's amazing though, that, you know, you're thinking about all this, not only the professional well-being, but also just, yeah, looking after yourself, making sure you're doing the things to recharge. As you're, as you said, it can get very, very busy on the wards. So yeah, very important things. I think that's applicable as well, not just to the surgery, but pretty much anyone, even as you're entering either F1 or entering into specialization training.
Biggest point to take away is for medical students and F1s and F2s is put yourself out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Put yourself out there. Look out for yourself as well. Look after yourself.
To summarize, yes, in 3, look after yourself, put yourself first. Like you always put your patients first, and like the GMC always say, but for your own well-being, put yourself first. And then make sure you put yourself out there for people to find out about you, because everyone has a unique set of skills, but you know, you have to put yourself out there. No one's going to go mining for you. You need to showcase yourself and either do it by going on social media or by networking, of course, without bragging too much. And the third thing is just to enjoy the process. Take each day as it comes.
Yeah. Brilliant. I think that's a lovely note to end on, really.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much for coming onto the podcast. It's been great. Lots of knowledge and little bits to take from that. And I think people will find it really, really useful.
And people will get rid of the stereotype of what orthopods are supposed to be like.
I hope so.
Amazing. And just a reminder that if anyone is keen to take part in the podcast, feel free to just email the podcasting team or the RGUC media team as well on any of our platforms, and we will be sure to get in touch with you.
We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Remember to stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media, for more exclusive content and updates. Thanks for tuning in to the Right Chamber podcast. Until next time.